Hello and welcome to the latest edition of Polling Matters. My name is Kieran Pedley and as usual I'm joined by Leo Barassi.
Hello.
And our second guest, pleased to welcome Hopi Sen today.
Hello.
As we approach the general election, attention will turn to the parties and their policies or pledges. But how much do the public actually trust what they hear? And how much do they believe that politicians are capable of delivering these promises? This is a question that has implications for each of the traditional parties, of course. The Tories want to believe there'll be a referendum after the next election. The Labour Party want to convince us that there may be freezes to our energy bills. And I guess the Lib Dems want us to believe that they can deliver the weekend after the parliament that they've had. This may play into the hands of populists like the Green Party and UKIP, who obviously, to varying degrees, have emerged in the recent past. But how do the major political parties that want to lead a government, such as the Labour Party and Conservatives, deal with this? Hopi, you've written something on this, haven't you? I mean, how can the major parties deal with trust? I mean, what should their policies be?
Well, I think you have to recognise why people are interested in populism and why populism... It's very easy to start off with the perception of populism as a negative and populism is a bad thing. It's not necessarily the case. The reason why people have an interest in what populist parties have to offer is because there is a perception, and quite an understandable perception, that centrist conventional politics has failed. And therefore, if you're going to offer a set of promises and be saying to the voters, this is what we're going to offer you, if your record in the last 5 years is one of more or less unmitigated failure, you're not necessarily in a particularly good position to make those promises and make those offers. So populists have two advantages to conventional politics in a sort of a period of apparent political failure. The first is that they are untouched by that past period of failure. Whether you're UKIP or Green, you can say, we are presenting an alternative. And that's something that almost all populist parties on the rise at the moment have across Europe, whether it's Syriza or Podemos or the Front National or the Sweden Democrats. And then the second element they have is that because they are not bound by conventional political promises, they are able to offer a much bigger picture. So if you talk about Podemos's leader in Spain, for example, he's kind of explicitly comparing himself to a kind of Leninist bread and peace policy that says, oh, I can offer you everything. Nigel Farage is able to say that everything is down to Europe, and if only we were able to leave Europe, we'd be able to solve everything from sort of overcrowding on the M4 to your local housing crisis. And if in normal times, that is relatively incredible. But when everybody else has equal incredibility and has a record of failure, then that promise is relatively more attractive and has a greater appeal. So my answer to that is that conventional politics, therefore, have to understand they're operating from a premise of distrust. And if somebody distrusts you and someone believes you're ineffective, instead of making bigger promises, you have to make much smaller promises and much more concrete and deliverable ones.
And how do you see that manifesting itself practically? Because obviously this is quite a difficult sell, presumably, for the Labour and Conservative parties. Yeah. You know, they're coming up against people offering the moon on a stick, as we might say. Are they going to be, offering dry, sort of very low-key policies might be quite
I think it's a very big problem for political strategists because of that exact problem. You have a culture in which you're being outbid and your temptation is to keep trying to bid higher. And the problem is you're never going to do it because you can't. There is a kind of degree of sanity inside most conventional political parties that mean that they're not going to offer things that they know they have no chance of delivering. And that draws them back from the kind of, well, of course, all we have to do is have independence, say, and from Europe or from the Union, and that will solve all of our problems and you can just fix everything around that. So if you take that route, it's never going to work. The reason why it's difficult to offer or difficult to sell is because we make one crucial mistake, is that when people say, oh, I can't see much difference by parties, the politicians are all the same, typically as people who care about politics, we read that as, I can't see much left-right difference. rather than I can't see any credible likelihood that this is going to make a difference in my life. And I think that's where you have to turn it around. Instead of thinking, oh, if we can demonstrate a radical difference in terms of what our political positioning is, that is much less relevant than demonstrating a radical difference or a credible difference in an impact in your actual life.
And Leah, there's a danger here, isn't there? Because ultimately, you know, any policy that any major party brings to the public attention, be it the Conservatives or Labour, is going to be immediately dismissed by the other side, isn't it? So isn't there a danger that politics kind of eats itself here?
There's a basic question of trust and distrust that I want to unpick. And I think, Hopi, if I'm understanding right, a lot of the argument is based on the principle that politicians now are seen as less credible to deliver their promises than they have been in the past. And instinctively, that feels right. That feels a reading of the public mood. But I haven't seen any evidence in the numbers of that. If you look at purely the do you trust politicians to tell the truth, then it essentially hasn't changed since the 80s. Politicians are as trusted now as they were at New Labour and as Blair was coming into power.
There was a dip post-2003.
Yeah, it's sort of within just outside the margin of error sort of territory, but certainly not far. There's a astonishingly counterintuitive finding that Gallup found that in August 1944, only 36% thought that politicians had the best interests of their country at their heart. And twice as many thought they were in it for themselves and for the party. So in that context, are we absolutely certain that at the moment politicians really are less able to convince the public because of the public mood? Or is it just that we don't have the politicians who are competent at doing that?
I would distinguish between trust in politicians and belief in the effectiveness of politics. I think that it is very easy to believe, take your immediate sort of war and post-war example, to have an equal level of trust in politics and live in a world in which it's easy to see that political levers, when pulled, have an impact, and therefore the choice is significantly mattered. So, and you know, this is always very useful for someone on the left of centre to read kind of mass observation of the 1945 to 50 government, and you really get a sense of the dissatisfaction and dislike that people had of the Labour government at that time. And it wasn't all sort of kind of roses and everyone loved the post-war consensus. It really wasn't like that. But what the world we live in now, I think, is one in which people are very aware of the limits of political effectiveness. And I don't think that's, I mean, I think of it as trust in the sense of, well, can you deliver what you say you're going to do, or credibility, rather than trust in that all politicians are liars. I don't think that's necessarily something that changes hugely. I find that quite comforting, because we tend to have a tendency to believe that kind of, well, there's a golden era of kind of, everyone believed in the 1950s when Harold Macmillan and Hugh Gaitskell were kind of delivering, everyone believed that the politicians were wise and noble. Well, no, they didn't. And I think that's a very fair point.
If we look at UKIP and the Greens, I mean, there is this kind of Dan Hodges-esque argument that, to coin a phrase, that, you know, as we approach the election, the Greens and particularly UKIP are going to get squeezed. I mean, is there a problem that the populist parties have, in a way, that as we get closer to an election, as we get closer to decision time, those fluffy, all-encompassing policies that may attract me to one of those parties, I actually don't think they can deliver them when it comes to it. So I'm going to return, in inverted commas, home to the traditional parties that I may have supported.
Well, the most interesting example of that I've seen in Europe in the last few years was the Dutch general election, where the kind of far left party declined very significantly in the 6 months prior to the general election, partly because the leader of that party and the kind of machinery around the leadership of the party kind of just didn't appear to be able to govern. Now, obviously, Dutch politics has kind of a long tradition which is very different to our own, and you wouldn't necessarily read across. But I think I wouldn't underestimate the chance that a significant proportion of the Green and UKIP vote that you see now, and also possibly the SNP vote in Scotland, will find its way back to the conventional parties, partly because of the question of credibility and partly just because the way the electoral system works, you will have to make a choice effort. Politics does have some impact. However, I would also make an argument that one of the interesting things for me about politics at the moment is not how well UKIP is doing, but how badly it's doing. Yeah, if I think of times and period to politics where both of the big two political parties have been politically failing, which I would regard as kind of like the late 1920s, early 1930s, and the early 80s, actually UKIP is doing historically badly compared to that period. And I would say that's part of the fact is because it has got that kind of, there's a huge number of people who would have voted for the SDP or would have voted for the Lloyd George's Liberals who would never vote for UKIP because they are very polarising. And I suspect that one of the reasons that the Green Party is beginning to do well is that in an environment where there is dissatisfaction with both major parties, there will be a kind of group of voters who say, well, I can't vote for UKIP, I don't really like the other lot very much. Well, where do I go? And the Greens are...
Leo, what do you think? Greens and UKIP, and we've talked about these over the past couple of weeks. I mean, do you think UKIP are doing badly? I mean, are the Greens doing well? I mean, where do you see these, in inverted commas, populist parties going?
Well, I'll go along with a lot of what Hope has just said. And I think they're two quite different phenomena, exactly as you said. And I think just talking about them as populist parties, as if sort of one's a populist of the left and one's a populist of the right, doesn't understand them because they do different things. Interestingly, I saw the Greens retweeting positively an article today by Harry Cole, I believe, that was... talking about them as the UKIP of the left, and I think that really does misunderstand their position. I think
why does it misunderstand their position?
Well, unlike UKIP, they are offering a set of policies to appeal to a completely different set of people. They're appealing to a politically engaged, angry but ultimately optimistic crowds. They're at the end of the scale, and Kieran, you and I have done plenty of polls where we said, where is this party on the past and the future? They're sort of the mirror image of they're the party that is talking about a bright future. UKIP are the party of talking about a bright past.
A very bad future.
Well, exactly, and clearly they both have problems with credibility. I think though, probably my biggest concern for Labour from the sort of the proposal of policies that are small and sensible is the difficulty that would have in winning back a lot of people who are now considering voting Green. A lot of people who probably voted Lib Dem in 2010 were going to vote Labour until a year ago or so and have now drifted towards the Greens. I can just see it's a few months after the election, Labour have performed dismally, and the post-mortem are saying Labour ran a lacklustre, small campaign that didn't inspire people, and they were unable to hold back the Green surge. The Greens got 8 or 9% of winning over a lot of people with big, bold promises. Now, there are also, I think, lots of problems of trying to win that group and the kind of things you have to do to win that group. But I'd be concerned about it being able to tackle that.
So, Hopi, is the problem that in Labour, in trying to protect competence and trying to protect an agenda that can be delivered, ultimately, we don't inspire people. People don't turn up to vote for them, or worse, they vote for somebody else, and therefore they don't win.
It's odd to me that this feels like a dichotomy, because when political parties are successful, whether it's Angela Merkel in Germany today or for the last 10 years, or Tony Blair probably up to about 2004, between 1994 and 2004, Thatcher in her pomp, even Macmillan, they don't feel like dichotomies. They feel like they're absolutely in chain. What you offer is credible and it is inspiring and it suggests that there is a real impact that things can have in your life. And I think what troubles me, I think, in Leo's point is that he's absolutely right in this. This will be the analysis. It'll be if you don't offer something that is big and bold and splashy, then you won't inspire people to come out and believe in you. And I think that's a mistaken analysis, not because there isn't a coherent argument to it, but because if you offer something to people that you actually believe that you're going to do, then I think that does inspire them. I think the problem that people have often with politicians and politics is that you say to them, we're going to let me pluck an example out of the air, freeze rents forever. And people say, well, that's a brilliant policy and it's really inspiring. And then another group of people go, well, that won't work, and peel off and vote for a party that isn't promising that. Well, both of those options are failures. If what you're able to do is address the concerns of the people who are concerned about rent by making a promise that's going to be deliverable and one that isn't going to cause people who are doubtful of the efficacy to peel off, you get both groups. And I think the question for politicians is, what can you offer that fits into both pools, that is credible enough to inspire and to make an impact and reasonable enough to not alienate those who believe in credibility? And I think that's the political challenge.
So to put that challenge into a specific example that of course has come up, what do you do if you pledge to put the minimum wage up to £9 an hour by the end of the parliament, and then the Greens say, we're going to make it 10, or a few months later say, actually, we're going to make it 11 or 12?
I think you make the absolute clear point, which is that there is a cost to that, which is the reason you put the minimum wage at the level you set that is that, and this is the interesting case about that particular case, is that if you put the minimum wage higher than the market can bear, then the people who will suffer are those in the casualisation section, younger workers, because they are less effective than middle-aged workers, and generally immigrants. So what you would end up doing in that situation is you would end up with a political offer that sounds good to the audience, but that would actually cause a huge barrier to them, barrier to them getting into work and barrier to them delivering. I also think, you know, there is a point at which it becomes ridiculous to try and chase this kind of bidding war. You know, you have to stand and say, this is what we think is the right thing to do and the reasons why it's the right thing to do. And if all you're doing is chasing, and this is a problem the Conservative Party has had for the last 5 or 6 years, if all you're doing is chasing and chasing and chasing, you're never going to get there. You have to at some point say, no, actually, this is the right thing to do and this is why it's the right thing to do.
I guess part of this debate is going to come back to how competent do the public think existing political leaders are. One of the striking elements of polling recently is that if you talk about best prime minister, David Cameron tends to have a lead over Ed Miliband. In fact, I don't think I've seen any poll that shows the opposite. And if you talk about economic competence, it's the same, isn't it? So are the Conservatives in a better position, actually, to promise more outlandish, more inspiring, to use a phrase, policies, because ultimately the public see them as more competent than Labour? I mean, is Labour's problem that ultimately, they can promise both big and small policies, but people don't believe they can deliver them?
I find it really difficult to understand Conservative Party strategy at the moment, because I think there is a huge gain for the Conservatives to aim at not chasing UKIP. I think if they tried to dominate the kind of the centrist vote to ground, they could easily, you know, be on 37-38% on the vote right now, with UKIP on the level that they're at, maybe a point or two less. You know, and the reason for that is fairly simple, is that when you look at the numbers up until sort of spring 2012, they were pretty much at that level. And the what cost them was not UKIP, not a surge to support for Euroscepticism, was a sense that they suddenly people stopped believing that they were on the side of people like them. And that was the basically the 2012 budget. So my response would be, the reason why the Conservatives are in a weak position is because they haven't got the crucial third prop of best prime minister and best on economy, which is the party that's best on the side of people like me. And until they get that back, they're going to find it very difficult, because they're not going to know who to chase after. And because they think at the moment people like me, the only way they get that back is to talk about immigration and Europe. And actually, I think that's absolutely the wrong approach for them. That if they were talking about issues of economic effectiveness and housing, and to an extent, weirdly, they're doing this in the north but not in the south, they would actually have a pretty effective chance to deliver all of that stuff.
We're now going to finish with our regular segment, Poll Finding of the Week, where us and our guests look at interesting data we've seen in the last week and what it means. Leo, what have you found?
Well, mine is, as usual, from one of Ashcroft's polls. And it's an interesting...
Does he pay you?
That'd be nice. It's an interesting one. He looked at... He essentially did an AV plus poll test in his poll. He asked people to give their first, second and third choice. And what surprised me wasn't what happened in the first choices, but what happened after that, particularly with the Lib Dems. So in the first choice, they came about where they do normally at the moment, 9%, they were fourth. Then the second choice, they came top. They were on 25%. Third choice, again, they came top, 27%. And, you know, in one way, it's perhaps not altogether surprising, knowing that the Lib Dems are lots of people's second choice. But it does sort of remind us that the narrative of the Lib Dem collapse and a lot of people being furious with them and unlikely to vote for them perhaps doesn't always hold as true as we might think. And you could see the significance of that for tactical voting, for constituencies where the Lib Dems are holding it thanks to Labour identifying tactical voters. I've thought for a while that those people might just not be able to bring themselves to vote Lib Dem. But I don't know, perhaps this poll suggests that they might be able to draw on a bit more of a well of anti-Tory support than I'd have thought.
And it's a common thing for political commentators to talk about is the death of a particular political party. I think over the last sort of 10, 15 years, we've read from all of the major parties, actually, oh, they're dead as an electoral force, aren't they? But actually, I think that maybe rumours of the deaths of the Liberal Democrats are greatly exaggerated. Hopey, what have you found?
I was going to do the one about Tony Blair's cat and Margaret Thatcher's Moggy, but I thought you were going to do that one. So I thought, oh, it's too obvious. There's no chance. In third place, but which was interesting because what it said was basically kind of Labour voters had a nice opinion of Labour owned cats, and Tory voters had a high opinion of Tory voters' cats, which kind of shows that partisanship is alive and well. But the actual one it comes from the British Election Study, which held their conference yesterday, looking at the 2015 election. And what it was looking at is this kind of long debated question about whether Labour or the Conservatives are more damaged by the rise of UKIP. And the conclusion that that Jeff Evans and John Mellon came to from looking at the data was that if you look at from 2010 to 2014, the overwhelming shift is from Conservative to UKIP. But when you look at the 2005 data, so people who were voted in 2005 and then gone back to and asked to look like who they were going to vote in 2014, a lot more Labour voters have transferred to UKIP. Now, there are two ways of looking at that. One is to say, well, that shows that the Labour core vote has been alienated by kind of increased liberal metropolitanism over the last 7, 8, 9 years. I'm doubtful about that, partly because Labour has actually significantly less liberal and sort of free marketeering now than it was then. But I think what is a function of popularity, is that the Labour Party in 2001 to 2005 had an appeal to C2 voters who may not have agreed with it on immigration in Europe, but believed that it was effectively delivering what they wanted in terms of their own lives and their own schools and their own living circumstances. As that failed and peeled away, those voters left, and they have left to UKIP. So it'll be interesting to see how that data is appealed, because the other question is, of course, is do you see 2005 Labour voters as core voters? And if so, what then is a core voter, given that Labour won the 2005 general election fairly easily?
I mean, Leo, could this be an irony of this next election where this switch of 2010 Conservative voters to UKIP actually hands Ed Miliband the keys to Downing Street, and yet in the long term, UKIP do more damage to Labour, particularly places up north where, you know, maybe some voters feel left behind?
I think the question for, or the thing that needs to happen for that to become a reality, is for UKIP to be able to survive as an established party after the next election. I think that that's unlikely. I think there are lots of factors that are going to be pushing against that. I think the problem of their reliance on Farage and what happens after the election, how they keep the momentum going, whether or not there's a there's an EU referendum. What they do if they have a couple of MPs, if the economy starts recovering, there are lots going to be lots of factors pushing against them. So it might well be that the first part of what you say happens, that in the election, Labour are helped by the presence of UKIP. Whether or not in the longer term that starts doing more damage to Labour than it already has done in terms of the defectors that, that Hope is talking about, I think depends on UKIP's survival, which I think is by no means guaranteed.
That was Polling Matters, and thank you again to our guest, Hopi Sen, and to my partner in crime, Leo Barassi. The music today is Pollinate by Kirk Pearson, licensed on Creative Commons. Goodbye.
Goodbye.